And when I was studying a few years ago, I came across a thing called family systems theory. It's a commonly used way of understanding families, and it's helpful for therapy for individuals and also the family. It's this idea that none of us live in isolation, that we're a self in relation, and that we're connected, interconnected with other people. And the way we connect and the way we respond to others drives the way we behave and influences the way we behave. So in a sense, family system theory is not new. It was just a way of explaining what we already experience, helps us understand it. Now, the reason I was studying it was that a guy called Edwin Friedman had taken those principles and said, well, a congregation essentially has the same processes in play, behaves the same way as a family, that all the, what he called the emotional processes that drive our behaviours and help the system function the same. And of course, he also applied this to organisations and even to whole communities. And one of the lessons in that is when someone seeks to change dysfunction in an organisation, in a church or a community or in a family, they will be sabotaged. And it's an interesting idea, and it works like this. So just imagine a family where there's an emotionally immature dad who's highly critical of everybody. And so everybody in the rest of the family, his children and his wife, walk on eggshells around him because he's angry and so quick to anger and might be violent, all of those things. What happens is the family finds a way to function in the dysfunction. All right, because they feel the weight of potential criticism or potential anger, they find a way to cope with that. And so they walk on eggshells. They avoid the subjects or the topics that might make the father angry. Now, that's a dysfunctional family, but the family finds a way to function in that. Now, what happens is one of the family members might say, this is not the way we should live. We need to change this. And they might defy the father, the emotionally immature father. And what you would expect to happen is that the other family members would rally around. But in fact, they don't. In most instances, the other family members will tell the person who tries to challenge their behaviour to be quiet. They'll say, don't rock the boat. Because one of the things that happens in systems is that they have this thing, it's got a big title, it's called homeostasis, or it's rest, right? So the system seeks to stay the way it is. That's harder to say than you might imagine. So the system resists change. And significant change actually requires disruption. There is no other way for it. Now, I've been thinking about this in terms of particularly Black Lives Matter and the protests that have been going on and the response of communities, the response of the system, response of people. One of the accusations levelled against Barack Obama when he was president was that America became more racist under him. Now, that's not really true, I don't think. What happened was that racism was more talked about. It disrupted. The conversations disrupted the system that had found a way to function in its dysfunction. So in a sense, what happened, the protests that started under Obama and in some way have been highlighted in recent days by the Black Lives Matter movement, they're actually natural, and that should encourage us, right? For a system to change, there will be disruption. Anxiety will rise. Tension will be high. That's what happens when systems change. And it's painful. If you want to change the way a family functions in a dysfunctional family, it will require pain and disruption and anxiety. You have to walk through that to come out the other side. So that should encourage us, really, in these troubled times. And I guess I've been thinking about these troubled times all week, and in particular, what should be our response as Christians? And really, my sermon today is prompted by that question, what would Jesus do right now? What would he say? What would we see on his Facebook account? What would we see on his Instagram account right now? What would he be saying? What would we be hearing from him? And two of the things that prompted me actually around what I'm going to say today actually appeared on social media. I've got slides of them here for you to see. Some of you may have seen this particular meme or this cartoon. And this is, of course, Jesus seeking out the one sheep who was lost and leaving the 99. And all the rest of the sheep have their placards that say, all sheep matter. Got another slide there. And I was brave enough to post this on my Facebook feed. That's how brave I am, what a rebel I am. The father was waiting there with a big sign, hashtag prodigal sons matter. When the older brother saw it, he was angry, wouldn't attend the party and moped around with his own sign, hashtag all sons matter. Father, dude, it's not about you right now. Now, I've been thinking about this idea of what would Jesus say? How does the gospel intersect with this issue of racism? In America, but that's not where I live, in Australia, how does this intersect with us, God's people? Would Jesus stand with the protesters or the police? Would he stand with both? Would he stand with neither? Our reading today was really a parable of grace. It's really a story about the character of God, a picture, if you will, of the kingdom of God. Now, we talk about grace all the time, and all our songs today have actually had that word in them, this idea of grace. And grace is often understood by evangelical Christians like us as centered around salvation. So often when we sing about grace, we sing about our memory of when we were saved and what God did for us. And it's true, we are saved by grace. But often we can think, without meaning to, that we're done with grace. We're grateful for it, but grace was in our past. And you see, that's simply not true. We live in grace now. We live in this extravagant, unjust, almost ridiculous grace of God. That's what that parable was about. It was unfair. It was unfair. Grace was unfair. There's this idea that runs through the Gospels that the last will be first, that God is concerned for the last. And there are people in our communities who are coming last. I've told you before the story of my neighbour Al, who came to seek our help because he knew we were Salvation Army officers. His mum, in her 60s, had died on the streets of the inner west. She was she'd been an alcoholic virtually from her childhood. She just had a messed up life, and she was a messed up mum. And, you know, my heart went out to Al as I wrestled with his story and what the kingdom meant for that. You see, he told me that his mum had come from a family of alcoholics. And I just compared that to my own story, growing up in a loving family, in a Christian environment. And I thought about Al's mum, and I thought about our starting points and how different they were. Did she ever really have a chance to be a great mum? You see, Al's mum was coming last compared to me, born into a loving family, surrounded by security and role models. I was often running or toddling, and she was way behind the start line. And the gospel, Jesus' teaching time and time again, says that God has a special interest in those who are last, in the lost, and in the suffering. Yes, all lives matter, but some people in our communities need more love and attention and time and resources than the others. And it's not about equality. Grace is not equality. It's not about all receiving the same love for the same work. This parable reminds us that grace is unfairly distributed. This grace, the unmerited favour of God. We might say, if it's the unmerited favour of God, does God have favourites? I've told you before about my maternal grandmother, my mum's mum, and what a good woman she was. She wasn't perfect. She had her bad days, all sorts of flaws. But she's a good woman. I admired her, and we all looked up to her immensely. She had a large family. She had 9 children and 30-something, I always lose count, grandchildren, and lots of great-grandchildren. And I remember when I was talking to my uncle after Nana died and we were preparing for a funeral, and I remember saying to my uncle, who were Nan's favourites? And my uncle said, whoever needed her the most. And I've thought about that idea that Nan's favourites were whoever needed her the most. And I think that reminds us of the character of God, the character of Jesus. Who did Jesus hang out with? Who were the people he sought out? Because I think Jesus had his favourites too. They were the outcasts, the disliked, the marginalised, the wounded, the ostracised. You see, Jesus said, blessed are the poor. And we don't correct him and say, no, Jesus, blessed are all people. Jesus said, blessed are the poor. He singled them out. One Christian writer said, perhaps God has a preferential love for the poor because they are poor. They need him the most, you see. With God, there are always mitigating circumstances. The people who are coming last need God's special attention, God's special favour. There are people and communities and families who will need him most. You see, the workers that are interesting in his parable are the ones who are left behind. They were the workers that no one wanted. When the landowner came back at the end of the day, they were still there. No one wanted them. No one had paid attention to them. And he said, come with me. And he gave them the same reward for the workers who had worked all day. So who would we say were Jesus' favourites? Who would he stand with in the Black Lives Matter protests? Would he stand in the centre? Would he say to us, listen to those who stand on the side of the least? Would he say, yes, some of my sheep need me more than others right now? Would he say, yes, I've always been in the business of seeking those who've been left behind, marginalised and discounted? And as my body on earth, as my people, that means they need you and me more than others do. You see, Matthew gives this story in the context of the upside-down kingdom. And immediately before it is another famous story. It's a story of the rich young ruler. And here was a young man who didn't get Jesus' message. Now, we know that these stories are linked. We're Bible scholars, right? If you look at the end of chapter 19, verse 30, it says, but many who are first will be last. And at the end of our story today, that Catherine read to us so well, so the last will be first and the first will be last. These stories are linked, you see. And in Matthew 19, Jesus says to this rich young ruler, give up your privilege and follow me. And it scares me, this story, if I'm honest, because I'm incredibly privileged. I'm a white male middle class person, the most privileged sociological group on earth. And the trouble is, it's too easy for me to dismiss the other's reality, a reality that I've never experienced. A couple of times I've had conversations with people about one of my heroes. And one of my heroes is Cathy Freeman. I think she was extraordinary, and I can still remember, I'll always remember, sitting on the lounge watching her run her final, when it seemed the weight of all of Australia, the pressure on her was just so enormous. And I was talking to people on two occasions. They said, look, didn't really rate her. I think she got a lot of attention because she was Indigenous. And I was surprised by this. I was surprised by this. Because for me, that's part of what makes her story so extraordinary. Because if you think an Indigenous kid born in central Queensland in the 70s didn't experience racism, I think you'd be wrong. And she thrived through it all, and she excelled through it all. This Indigenous kid who could run fast, and she's a great role model, and she's a hero for me. Why would we question that? Why would we devalue that? You see, I want to give up my privilege. I don't want to be the rich young ruler. I need to remember, I need to be reminded that Jesus came to announce an upside-down kingdom where the last will be first. That I need to show God's grace in my life, this grace that's offered freely and generously to the world. Our story that we read today reminds us that we don't earn grace. We don't own grace. It's not ours to keep, but ours to give away. God's grace is offered to the world through us as we actively seek out those people and families and communities that need us the most. We seek out God's favourites. Before we saw some words on the screen, we listened to a tune, and it's a famous song in the Salvation Army, My Life Must Be Christ's Broken Bread. And it's a song of what we call a sacramental life. And it's a song I wrestle with, if I'm honest, this idea that our lives could somehow be a sacrament. But if that song is to mean anything at all, it means that for us, that other souls refreshed and fed should share the life of God through me. You see, the sacraments are a means of grace, a practice and behaviour that brings others afresh into the experience of grace. And I've honestly struggled with this. How do we live this out as salvationists, if this is indeed our special calling? Because if it is our calling, it should be obvious in our actions. What does it look like to live as a means of grace to the world? You see, God's extravagant grace is offered to all, but particularly to those who need it most. And those of us who, like the rich young ruler, like the labourers hired first, like the older brother, who have it all, have the responsibility to go back and seek anyone who has been left behind. That's what grace does, you see. Grace seeks the one who's been left behind. And we say to them in our words and actions, His grace is for you. His grace is more than enough. Come share in it with me. Come join us at the table. Grace listens. And that should be our posture right now, if you're like me, right? A person of privilege. Always remember that story of Jesus with the Syrophoenician woman. Don't know if you remember the story. Jesus had kind of taken a sabbatical. He'd left his ministry and he'd headed outside kind of Jewish territory. And this woman from Syrophoenicia, what we might call Lebanon now, came to him and asked for his help for a daughter who was ill. And Jesus at first refused her. But he listened to her and she pleaded again. And she pleaded again and Jesus listened. And it seems that he changed his mind. Even though she was other, he listened. And there's an example in that for us. I think grace listens. Now, it is true that sometimes Jesus acted. Sometimes he announced. Sometimes he challenged. But sometimes he listened. And this right now is one of those times when we need to listen. Like you, I've seen lots of posts on social media, and some of them, if I'm honest, have disturbed me, from good people, from Christians. And it just seems to me that what's at the heart of this is that we're not listening. And I'm disturbed by our refusal to listen. You see, don't imagine a mob. Don't imagine a group of people. Imagine if one black person came to you and said, I was ignored, mocked and insulted today because of my skin colour and I'm hurt and upset. You couldn't possibly answer, no, you're not. But that's what we've done. Imagine if it was you. Imagine if you went to someone and said, I'm hurt and upset. And someone said, no, you're not. Grace is also generous. Grace errs on the side of generosity. Grace risks being taken advantage of rather than any possibility of diminishing the other, depriving the other. You see, right now, in our country, in Australia, when we're talking about this issue, which I think is a good thing, I don't want to be the older brother. I don't want to say they don't deserve it, they're lazy. Because God says, they're my children. I don't want to be like the workers chosen first who toiled all day and look at the other and say they haven't earned it. God says, they're my loved children. In this upside down kingdom, you and I are called to offer grace to the world. Through me and you, God's extravagant grace is offered to all, but particularly to those who need it most. I want us to sing about grace. I want us to reflect on grace. How we take this grace to the world around us. What does it mean for you in what you say, in what you type, in your attitudes, in what you listen to, and how you listen? Our musicians are going to sing us a beautiful song. I love this song. It's a song about grace. And yes, it speaks out of that experience of us knowing God's grace. But let's think about this grace and how we can offer it to the world around us. Let's listen and reflect.